New Generation Engineering, the podcast for building engineers. Today we have an extremely special guest today, Mike Kiesog. Mike Kiesog is the Executive Director of Client Relations. How you doing, Mike?
I'm doing great. Thank you for having me, Dave.
Well, I'm so happy you're here. And I don't know how the heck I got you to get on this show. You have been extremely difficult to get a hold of, and I know you're very busy. There's a lot of stuff going on right now. This is budget season, and everybody is scrambling to get all these numbers in. So I was one of them. I was one of the people calling you to get some of these budget items in. How did I get you in here?
You called. We talked. I've known you guys a long time, and an honor to be here. This is an honor for me to be here and do this podcast with you. Thank you.
Well, thank you. And I know you've been involved with organizations like BOMA, and you've done some other stuff, you know, through other organizations with NFPA. Can you talk about a little bit about those organizations that you've been involved with and some of the stuff that you've done?
Yes, I've worked with the BTO, BOMA BTO, over the years. Have not been involved as of recently, but have worked with the group before. And as far as NFPA, I am one of their CESCPs, Certified Electrical Safety Compliance Professionals. Last time I checked, there was about 110 of us in the world that have that certification. And basically, it's just a certification from the NFPA that you take a test, you have to pass certain qualifications. And it basically says, hey, they know electrical safety, the NFPA 70E standard that they write. It's their qualification for that standard.
Wow, that one out of 100 people. And how long ago was that again?
The last time I looked was probably 2 or 3 years ago, and it was 100 people. And there's probably a lot more now.
Yeah.
But at that time, there was 100. And wow. I've had that for at least three or 4 years now.
Wow, that's phenomenal. That kind of reminds me a little bit about the LEED GA. When I got my LEED GA, my LEED Green Associate, I was one of only a few people here in Georgia that had that, so that's totally awesome.
Thank you.
And please tell me a little bit more about yourself. I know you have a big family.
Yes.
Happy family.
Yes.
Tell me a little bit about your family and your personal life. What do you do, you know, during your off time?
Yes. Well, I have three young boys, a 15-year-old, a 12-year-old, and a 10-year-old, and they keep us very busy. I have a lovely wife that I've been married to. We're coming up on our 19th year.
Wow,
which is any woman that can put up with me for 19 years, she's a keeper. So anybody that knows me, they would say the same thing. So what I like to do in my off times, I spend a lot of time with my family. We do a lot of camping, RV camping with the family. Really enjoy that. And like I said, it's a family thing for me. I work and I spend time with my family, and that's about all I do.
Well, that's awesome. And I you know, you have such a great positive attitude. And I know you mentioned about the special camping. That what's that term you made?
It's called glamping. But I did not phrase that. It's just something in the industry. But yeah, I'm not sleeping in a tent. I'm too old and my back's too bad to sleep in a tent. Yes.
And that means glamorous camping.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Okay. In an RV with air, bathrooms, running water. Yeah. You won't catch me in a tent.
That's funny. Well, we'll have to catch up later on because you're supposed to tell me where I can go to go get my camper.
Yes.
So let's dive right in. Let's get into today's topic, and that is on NFPA, more specifically NFPA 70E, and what exactly that means and stuff like that. So let's dive right in. What exactly is NFPA 70E? Is it like one or two items? Is it multiple items? Is it a bunch of stuff? Or what? And of course we'll get into the some of the things that we need to do as engineers to make sure that we're taking all the precautions and, more importantly, what we need to do to stay in compliance. So please tell us a little bit more about NFPA 70E.
Yeah, NFPA 70E is the nationally recognized standard. It's a standard, not a code, which means it's not required, but it is the nationally recognized standard for electrical safety in the workplace. OSHA uses NFPA, and OSHA 3075, OSHA states that they do base their electrical safety guidelines on NFPA 70E. So it's a standard that OSHA uses to help enforce its codes. That's how I interpret it. And there's a lot of guys in the industry that interpret that as well. We get a lot of questions, does OSHA enforce NFPA 70E. Robert Terrell, who used to be the head of OSHA or the Department of Labor, was asked years ago, does OSHA enforce NFPA 70E? And his response was, OSHA does not per se enforce NFPA 70E, but they deem you compliant with OSHA 1910 if you follow 70E guidelines. So in my mind, yeah, it's being pushed as a requirement.
Okay. And I know with NFPA, particularly NFPA is you know, when we talk about standards, they have a bunch of standards. NFPA has so many standards, and it is on the local jurisdiction to have an authority that's going to say, we are going to use these standards based on NFPA. Right. They don't use all of them. I don't know that there's any particular state that uses 100% of NFPA standards, because they just don't apply or they are more lenient.
Yes.
And for the most part, here in Georgia, you know, we got state codes and we got NFPA codes, and then we have authority having jurisdiction, which, you know, as I mentioned for our listeners in my previous program with Renee Serrano, I had an electrician inspector tell me that we should not have a sprinkler head inside the electrical room. And then I had the sprinkler inspector tell me that it needs to be removed. So, you know, at that point in time, I was figuring, what do I need to do now? Who do I need to speak with? Because we are not going to get the certificate of occupancy if I don't get this corrected. So the authority having jurisdiction is the one that helped me out with that. And so would you agree with that?
I would say with NFPA 70E, it's more on a national scale, because OSHA, the federal portion of it, is pushing people to follow those guidelines. So when I say they're pushing them, they're basing their electrical safety on NFPA 70E. So if there is a lost time accident in a facility, what I have seen is OSHA comes in and they, as they do their inspection or their investigation, we'll call it whatever, they're going to refer back to 70E. Did you do this? Did you do this? Before they issue fines and things of that nature. That's what I've seen from an industry standpoint. So with NFPA, it's a little bit different. It's on a federal, you know, the OSHA is a federal organization, hence it's on a national level. And we see it across the country.
Okay, all right. Well, let's talk about Arc Flash, and let's talk about how that relates to, obviously, NFPAE. So can you tell us a little bit more about Arc Flash, some of the things that we should be doing? I've seen in many switchgear in buildings where there's a sticker that says Arc Flash inspection analysis has been performed, and I'm sitting here thinking, well, how often do I need to do this? Can you tell us a little bit more about Arc Flash?
Absolutely. The NFPA 70E has requirements not only for Arc Flash, but for shock hazard analysis. They have a requirement for a safety program. They have requirement for training. So let's talk about the Arc Flash portion of it. What that requires is that an Arc Flash risk assessment be done on the facility. And during that assessment, what you're doing is you're assessing each piece of electrical equipment. And the equipment, that's a question we get as well, is what equipment? If it's likely to require examination, adjustment, or service while energized, it needs to be assessed. And during that assessment, you're assessing that to determine what the potential amount of energy that can be released on your body is during an arc flash incident. Mm-hmm. Once you know the amount of energy, you can then say to the electrician working on the panel or switch or transformer or whatever they're working on, this is the PPE, personal protective equipment, you must wear to protect yourself from getting a second degree burn.
Okay. And I understand there's different certain arc flash requirements and different PPE required for specific types of equipment. I mean, I imagine, correct me if I'm wrong, do I need to put on some PPE to reset a breaker?
Yeah, and that's a great question. That's great. We get that question all the time. And what the NFPA states is, inside the 70, it says if you are going to interact with it or expose it where there is an increased likelihood of an arc flash occurring, you must wear PPE to do that. So I'll ask you, if I'm going to operate a breaker, am I increasing the likelihood that an arc flash could occur, whether the cover's on or not?
I don't know how to answer that.
See? And that's a question. That's something I always ask that question. And from a lot of people, I get that back. Well, I don't know. Yes, there is. Because when you interact with it, you're increasing the likelihood that there's going to be an arc flash. The breaker could fail when you operate it. And people say, oh, I get the comment a lot, well, the cover's on. I have seen numerous videos where the cover's blown off. Mm-hmm. So to take that a step further, I get the question, okay, Mike, do you put on PPE to reset your breaker at your house? Well, that's a 20 amp single pole breaker. The assessment would tell me there's very little likelihood of a huge arc flash. So no, I use my left hand rule, I look away and I operate the breaker, but a 400 amp three pole breaker, yes, you can bet I'm not, because I'm not a qualified electrician, but the electricians that work for me, they would put on PPE and operate that breaker or a main switch in that case, yes.
Yeah, I've seen these long sleeve shirts button up, mm-hmm. And they have a sign, I guess like a label that yep. says that it is like basically arc flash yep. protection, mm-hmm. and it has a certain calorie rating. Mm-hmm. And if I wanted to maybe perhaps start thinking about, hey, let's take this arc flash a little more serious and let's start thinking about putting on this button-up shirt and whatever other arc flash equipment, like do I need to put mats down in front of these breaker panels and make sure that, you know, I have some protection there? You know, what kind of shirt, what kind of calorie would I have to get on a button-up shirt to reset a breaker?
Okay, so that's a great question. Again, your questions are great. No, the calorie rating is going to be listed. If you've had an arc flash assessment done, you're going to have labels that were installed to tell you what the rating is of that panel. And again, it's if you interact with it or expose it. Well, operating it is interacting with it. So what you would do is walk up to the label. You'd look at the label, and the label would say 10 cal, you would make sure, and then it lists the PPE, you would make sure that the PPE you put on is a minimum of 10 cal, and it's all of the PPE that's listed on there, whether it be a hard hat, face shield, safety glasses, earplugs, but it would have to meet that minimum rating of 10 cal. Can you go higher? Sure you can. Can you go lower? No. And people say, well, we're just going to put all of our guys in a 40 cal suit. And I'm not sure if you've ever seen a 40 cal suit, but I always refer back to the Back to the Future movie where Marty goes back in time and he's in that suit. And,
yeah.
Okay, that is very similar to what a 40 cal suit's. I want you to imagine grabbing a 20 amp breaker screw with that big suit on. You can't do it, so it would make it more dangerous.
Right.
So my recommendation is look at the label, and if the label says 10 cal, put on that PPE, and then operate the breaker or switch or whatever piece of equipment you're working on.
Okay, okay. Well, obviously it sounds like more doesn't mean better. So
actually, yes.
So is that correct?
Yes, and this is why I say that. Again, you could be putting yourself in danger working in tight spots mm-hmm. with heavy PPE on.
Right.
Okay? So yeah, in some cases, do we go a little bit higher? Sure, people do.
Mm-hmm.
But there's common sense that goes along with this, and this comes back to another section of 70E, the training portion and the safety program portion that's required of 70E. What's in the company safety program? What's in their training for their technicians or electricians, whoever's doing the work? You know, are they allowed to do that work? Do we need to call in a contractor? Those sort of things that need to be answered in your safety program and your training program for your teams at your buildings.
Okay. And I've seen it before where specific engineers, and they're kind of neat, they have a belt where the buckle is actually covered with a leather
mm-hmm.
kind of cover,
mm-hmm.
and it's an arc flash type of piece of you mm-hmm. know PPE, and of course we talked about the mats have to be down. There's a specific type of mat
yeah.
or rubber that you needs to be put down in front of you know the breakers and
mm-hmm.
breaker panels, and so that you know, it's a mat of protection.
Yeah.
So are those assessments something that Ally does?
Like, yes.
Or companies like, you know, much like the line of work that you guys
yeah.
do to be able to say, hey, this is what you need.
Yes.
And you know, to better protect yourself.
Right. So so let's talk about an arc flash risk assessment and what it entails. So an arc flash risk assessment, like I said, is an assessment of your building's electrical system
mm-hmm.
to determine when working on a piece of electrical equipment, what PPE you should wear to protect yourself from getting a second degree burn. Okay, so part of that assessment is coming in and gathering data. So that's going to be things of cable length, cable type, breaker settings, fuse type. All those things go into the calculation to determine what the calorie rating is of that piece of equipment. So you have that portion, you have to gather the data. Then that data gets sent back to an engineer who actually, and this is an engineer or a drafter who's going to model it, build a one-line model of your system. And then from there, they're going to calculate out at each piece of equipment based upon the device that's feeding it, the cable length, cable type, breaker type, and then the amount of energy that can be delivered from the system. All that goes in, time and energy equal the calorie rating. Then you print a label and put that label up, and that label says, okay, if you're going to work on this panel, it's rated 8 cal, you must wear this, and it's got to have a minimum rating of 8 cal.
Okay, very interesting. Time and energy equals the type of calorie,
yep,
PPE you're going to be wearing. Yeah. Okay.
And there's some other factors that go into it, but the main two ingredients are time and energy. The longer it takes the trip device to trip, the higher the cal rating. And then people say, well, I'm going to lower the trip time. But if you increase the calorie rating, you could increase it. So it's very unique. It's all based upon a formula that the IEEE came up with. And in the end, it's time and energy. But there's other things. The type of cable plays an effect, the length of the run. But most of it is time and energy.
Okay. Well, good, good. You know, now, in the past, I know, especially during you know, like a tornado event or inclement weather, or simply because we lost utility power at some point or another, you know, or perhaps our switchboard, our switch gear is weak, it trips and it turns off the riser, the whole building. Sometimes you have a low rise and a high rise, sometimes you just have one low rise, and I have to reset all these circuits in the building, and every floor has a specific disconnect, yep, tap. So, I mean, for our listeners, if you ever obviously lost power to your building, there's a certain way that that you would obviously turn those circuits on. But if you trip the main, or if you had to turn off the main by pressing the reset button, because, you know, perhaps you're single phasing or something like that, you know, Mike, can you tell us how should we properly reset? Do we just throw the main switch on with just our regular street clothes, or,
yeah,
or obviously there's obviously, you know, and I'll let you talk, but I'm sure there's a if you've done an arc flash assessment, you know what PPE to wear first and foremost. That's very important, but at the same time, what do I do? How do I turn it on? Is it okay for me to do it? Who's qualified?
Right.
You know, those are the type of things that come up to my mind. You know, it's like, what am I gonna? Am I in potential of any kind of you know hazard? Am I endangering anybody,
yeah,
or anything? So I'm sorry. So this is a full loaded,
yeah,
lot of questions there.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, let's talk about that and let's kind of go through the process. So you get you come in, you get a phone call. Of course, it's not on Monday at 2 p.m. It's on Friday, Saturday morning at 3 a.m. And you have to come in as the building chief engineer or the building engineer. You have to come in and you make the call and you say, Mike, our building's down. We need some help. Please get out here. And we send a team out. The first thing the team's going to do is assess what caused the outage. Okay, was it that there, you know, and what function did the main trip on? You know, if it's a breaker, did it trip on short time, instantaneous, ground fault? That's going to tell us a lot, because you don't just want to go resetting things, because if you didn't clear the fault, guess what it's going to do when you turn it back on? It's going to trip again.
Absolutely.
So, but let's just say it was a freak trip, or a motor was going bad and you found that motor and you've disconnected that motor from the system, so you know it's not going to trip. The first thing we would do is go through and open up all of the bus taps on all the floors to reduce the load for when Georgia Power or whomever is the building utility provider. So when they put power back on the building, it's not seeing a huge incoming rush of energy. So basically what we would do is go through and open all the bus taps, and then we would open all the feeders in the main and open the main. The main should be open if it tripped, but we would make sure it's open. Then they would close the main, their fuses. Now you have power coming into the building, and you go into the building, and basically turn back on the main, and go right down the line. Turn back on the main, turn back on the feeders, and go right up through the building, turning on the bus plugs.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And so you definitely, you hit on something very 101, and that is, you know, obviously don't just reset it. You got to find out what caused it. If there's still a ground, situation, it's gonna trip again.
So yeah,
you don't want to do that. You could potentially blow something up.
Yeah, not something, someone.
Or someone, right? Of course. Right. And of course, you know, people are the most important
<That's right. laughs>
asset in any building.
Yes, yes.
So, in terms of that, so wow, very good information on that. I have to ask, how often, going, and not to go back too much, but how often should I do an assessment? Is it every year, every other year, every 5 years? Is it based on time of usage?
Right.
You know.
Right. No, that's another great question. Basically, the NFPA stipulates that after a major modification is done to the system, or a period not to exceed 5 years.
Okay.
Most of our clients that we see are sticking to that 5 year, but we do have some that, you know, I recently just had a client in Houston who just did his assessment a year ago, and he called me and he said, we've replaced all the switchgear, what do we do? Well, you got to start over and redo your assessment. And that's what we did. We redid his assessment for him and so forth. So either after a major modification or renovation to the electrical system, or a period not to exceed 5 years. And the other thing is, people ask me this question, and this will cost you no extra, but yeah.
I'm buying you lunch.
You're buying me lunch. That's good. So basically, people always ask me, what happens if we add 3 panels? Do we have to redo the whole thing? And what I tell people at that point is, you know what? No, you don't need to redo the whole thing, but you need to add those 3 pieces of equipment to the existing study.
Okay.
And so a lot of times they'll call whoever did the study and say, hey, we're adding 3 pieces of equipment. We can provide you that data. All you're going to need to do is add it to the study and send us labels, and then give you a price to do that.
Okay. Wow. Mm-hmm. Some really good stuff. And of course, I don't want to get too much into it, but I know you guys do thermal scans also.
Yep.
and do certain assessments like that. What can I do? What should I do? Or, you know, for our listeners, what you know, for the engineers, what should we do on a preventive maintenance, you know, on a daily basis or on a regular basis, on a monthly or quarterly maintenance program? What is it we do? You know, should we exercise our switch gear on and off just to try it out, make sure to get exercised? You know, stuff that normally a contractor doesn't necessarily have to do, but we can do in-house. Is there anything that we can do on our end to make sure that we are doing some preventive maintenance, so to speak?
Yeah. The infrared is a great tool.
Mm-hmm.
And for years, a lot of people were doing the infrared on a 12-month cycle. So every 12 months, somebody was coming in their building and doing an infrared, which is good. But the issue that we have seen with that is if you do it every 12 months, you're hitting it either. So if you do it every year in December, you're hitting it on the cold heating load on the building. If you do it every year in June, you're hitting it on the cooling load in the building. So we've kind of recommended an 18-month plan.
Okay.
To do that, and or you can do every 12 months in the cold months and then come back and hit the heating load in June, because there's usually less heating load. You got some chillers and disconnects. You may have an air handler on each floor, but depending on the building, it may work to do it not a full scan every 6 months, but a full scan in December and then a smaller scan, you know, just hitting the heating load in July, August, you know, June, those sort of time frame. As for what the building could do, you know, go in your electrical rooms. We go to a lot of places, and you walk in the electrical room, you can't open the door.
Yeah.
And you got, you know, I see the smile. It would never happen at your building,
yeah, no.
But I'm sure you see that.
Yeah,
you know, you go in your buildings, you know, use your ears. You know, do you hear a lot of noise coming from a panel? You know, there's not really much. I wouldn't recommend operating them because, again, are they qualified to operate them? Are they in PPE? But an infrared is probably the most cost-efficient way to do a full PM. I never saw it because I'm too young, but I was told when I first started in this field that years before infrared technology came about in electrical, they would flood buildings with electricians, 30, 40 electricians, and they'd go around and tighten every connection in the building they could, and cost a lot of money. And a lot of times it caused problems that weren't there. You start over-tightening a bolt. So infrared is the number one way, but I always tell people you use your eyes and ears. You know, when you walk into a room, listen, look, you know, do you see a burn mark on a panel? Maybe something happened, you know, those sort of things.
You know, those are very simple concepts, and really that applies to any of the preventive maintenance work that we do. Whether you're doing HVAC, electrical, plumbing, use your senses, use your eyes. You know, do you see any burn marks like you mentioned? You know, do you hear a loud buzzing sound coming from your transformer or from a breaker? You know, maybe use your nose. Does it smell like something like something's burning type of thing, like plastic? So very easy things to spot just by using your senses without even using any other tool. Yeah. You know, so that's really good stuff there. I want to ask about bus torquing. Is that the same thing as the annual or 5-year analysis? Is that part of it? Why is it important? And I noticed that when I look at it, and I look at the bus riser, there's like it says something about the tightness and poundage. Yep. What does that mean?
Okay, so let's talk about that. Bus riser is unique in itself. Bus riser carries the power through the building, and then you have bus plugs that are plugged into it, and that comes out and feeds each floor. So your first question was, do we need to torque bus riser? Well, there are people that believe it doesn't need to be torqued. It's, you know, it's fine. Our recommendation and the International Electrical Testing Association, mm-hmm. who is NETA, which is another standard written that kind of governs testing procedures for switchgear maintenance, would have something different to say about that as well. Mm-hmm. But basically, so what you would do is, yes, it's part of your 5-year maintenance. So every 5 years, you would do your switchgear service, you know, testing your mains, operating your mains, testing your ground faults, torquing your bus inside the switchboard. But then also going through the building, and what you do is you meg the bus riser to determine the continuity through the bus riser. Then you go through and torque all the connections. So you have a pre and post meg reading to determine, did we see an increase? And 95% of the time, we're seeing an increase in the continuity through the system. So, yes, we would recommend. Now, there is bus that is designed not to be torqued. It's locked in place. It's got locking lugs. Yes, you don't want to. But that would be up to the building and to the contractor doing the work to say, hey, we can't torque that. It's a locked bus. Yeah. So, yes, it is part of the service, and it is something, in my professional opinion, should be done every 3 to 5 years along with your switchgear maintenance.
Every 3 to 5 years. Okay. I'm writing that down.
Yeah.
3 to 5 years. Okay. I hope you don't charge me for any consulting.
I do right now. It's as a matter of fact, I just emailed the office. They're sending you an invoice.
Dang.
We're quick about invoices.
Yeah, holy cow. Okay, well, great. That's a nervous laugh. So if I wanted to learn more about NFPA 70E and how I can get more involved in making sure that our buildings and our people, you know, which is our most important asset, are protected, where do I go for that type of information? Who do I talk to? Is there a one-stop shop? Do you provide any training? Does your company provide any training? You know, or is there any other avenues that I can go to?
Okay. Yes, there's several avenues. Yes, our company, Allied, offers the training, the arc flash assessment, the program, safety program development and writing. We offer a complete turnkey product for NFPA 70E, but there's also a very good website that a lot of the industry uses. It is called arcflashforum.com.
Okay.
It is a great most of the industry that's doing this type of work, and some of the smartest minds are on those boards daily. And you can go on there and post questions, and you'll get an answer. You can email back and forth, and they have everything from, you know, what should be on the label to the new changes coming in the next revision of 70E, which will be every 3 years. So 2021 should be the new revision because we have a 2018. Of course, 3 years will be 2021.
Okay.
And that's basic math. Don't ask me to multiply nothing. But I can add. So Arc Flash Forum is great. I can help you. More than welcome to reach out to me anytime and ask questions. Anything along those lines. The NFPA website, you can order the 70E book. And then something that we didn't cover, but I'll just touch on real quick, is the second chapter in 70E covers maintenance on your equipment.
Okay.
So we're talking about doing an arc flash and a shock risk assessment, but what about the testing portion of your gear? So the NFPA recommends that you test your gear following industry standards, which would be NIDA, manufacturers or industry company standards like ours that does testing. So you could reach out to any one of them, but my recommendation for Arc Flash is Arc Flash Forum, and maybe buy the NFPA standard, or and then when it comes to testing, go to NIDA and order the NIDA book, and that's going to have a lot more than you need in it. I do have a document that we use. More than welcome to reach out to me, and I'll send that to you.
More than you need a.
Okay. Yeah, more than you need a. There you go.
Well, you're talking about it, and I do want to kind of cover it a little bit.
Yeah.
But that you're talking about taking our switchgear equipment, our major breakers, and taking them off site somewhere to get tested and lab checked?
No.
Or?
We do all that on site.
Okay.
So, and when I say we, testing companies as a whole, will come out and they'll have a test set, mm-hmm. and they'll pull the breakers out of the equipment. Sometimes you can test them in the equipment, and you'll put fault current through them to make sure they're going to do what they're supposed to do. And a lot of people say, well, Mike, isn't that stressing the breaker? Absolutely, it's stressing the breaker. And yes, will it damage a breaker that's already damaged? Sure it will, but you'd rather find it when you're testing it, that's why you're doing this, than letting it fail in the middle of the night when you see a trip, and then you go to reset it on a Saturday morning at 3 a.m., and you go, okay, where do I get a breaker, a 4,000 amp main breaker? So it's designed to do that. But I tell people this, the breakers are designed to trip hundreds of thousands of times, but they fail. They're a mechanical device.
Yeah.
So.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, you know, one of the things that I like to talk about a lot on my show here is basically developing a good partnership with the people we work with, and also treat the client, or you know, we're your client and you're our customer, and our, you know, we're your customer,
yeah.
and so we're customers of each other,
yeah.
and we want you guys to feel that like you're an extension,
yeah.
to our team. That said, what are the industry practices, common practices, good practices from an electrical standpoint that you would like to share with our listeners, with the engineers, good common practices,
yeah.
that we can make sure that we take care of, something that we need to be looking out for.
Yeah, I would, and we kind of hit on this, is the infrared,
mm-hmm.
doing that infrared every 12 to 18 months. Doing switchgear maintenance is so important, because what I say to people is, it may not shut down today, it may not shut down tomorrow, but it's going to shut down at 3 a.m. on a Saturday morning. That's how it works.
Okay.
You know, I never get the call on a Monday morning at 8 o'clock, yeah. when you walk in the door, hey, my building shut down this morning. Everybody's here. Yeah. Send somebody out. It's Friday at 6 o'clock when you're driving home and the building calls. So do infrared, do switchgear maintenance, and most of all, safety-wise, follow NFPA 70E guidelines when it comes to electrical safety in your building. It is the industry standard guideline across the country. Canada has a version of 70E that mirrors, it's not called 70E in Canada A, it's their version, but it mirrors 70E. It is something that's very important.
Okay.
So those three items, if you can follow those three items, it'll help with the electrical reliability of your facility.
Okay. Fantastic. You know, there is so much to cover on NFPA 70E, and we would have to have a part 1 through 15 to even touch on some of the stuff that 70E covers. Now, I do know that I'm going to be calling on Mike to help with getting more guests to talk about other stuff on our next podcast, or some podcasts going down the road, to talk about motor analysis, and go into thermal scans, and go into other items that Mike does and some of his firm does that would help us, the engineer. Mike, we're getting towards the end of the segment here.
You have tissues? Because I'm going to cry. I'm like, I got to leave, man.
No. Of course, if you want to share some more. I know you're a very important person, and I am very lucky and very fortunate that you're here in the engineering shop to record this podcast. But I want to go to the exciting part of my podcast, and that's when I get to ask you some random questions. But for the first question I wanted to ask you is, who has been most influential in your life, either at home or work, and why?
Okay. Now, are we talking business influential, or are we talking personal influential?
Well, this is... I do have a rating on this recording, so if you can keep it PG-13.
Oh, no, I can keep it PG-13. I'm just saying, if my wife's going to hear it, she is the most influential person.
Okay.
No, but let's talk about professionally.
Okay.
Professionally, I have a dear friend of mine. His name is Randall Bentley.
Okay.
Randall has been in my life a long time. He's a friend, a business partner, a confidant. A very strong Christian man. He's planted several churches. But professionally speaking, Randall has helped me from the time I started my first business to owning all the businesses I own now. He's actually a partner in every business I have.
Wow.
With the exception of Allied. But he has been the most influential. He's been there to guide me, help me, keep me out of trouble.
Yeah.
Make sure I make the right things. And then personally, I of course would have to say my wife. And I know I joked in the beginning, but she's always there to listen. She's always been there to support me, no matter what decision I made, from, leaving one job and doing my own thing. And I'll tell you, one of the scariest things you'll ever do in your personal life is start your own business. But the rewards are worth it. And
right.
She supported me through that. So I'm very grateful.
That's awesome, because again, as you mentioned, you've been together for 19 years, and anybody can put up with you
for 19 years. Listen, I would have said that after the first 2 days. I would have said, it's her. She's awesome. No, but she is. She's my rock, my confidant, and she's great. So
okay,
yes.
Now, I'm sure she has told you this, and this is my next question. So if you've seen this movie over 100 times, and if it was on, and you would watch it, which movie would that be? It would be one of those movies where your wife says, oh my gosh, you're watching that movie again. And so what movie would that be?
It would be Caddyshack.
Caddyshack.
Yes.
Rodney Dangerfield.
The first Caddyshack with Rodney Dangerfield and Chevy Chase. Yes, probably, in my opinion, one of the best movies ever made.
Okay.
So has Bill Murray in it as well. So,
Bill Murray.
Yeah.
A lot of good people there.
Yeah, yes.
I usually walk around the engineering shop here thinking, I get no respect. I get no respect. Okay, all right. And then lastly, if you had one more meal choice, one last meal choice, and it was, you're on death row, I don't know, you know the world's going to end, what meal choice would that be? Where would you get it from? Or what would it be?
It would be probably a simple, fresh shrimp cocktail.
Shrimp cocktail.
Nothing beats a fresh shrimp. When I get to go to the ocean front, which I don't get to do very often, and I can get down there and order fresh shrimp, not the frozen stuff you get at Red Lobster now, but the fresh shrimp. Yes, that would be my last meal.
Okay. And then any particular place you would get that fresh shrimp, would it be from a, you know, here in Georgia, I've heard of, I haven't been there yet, but I'm not trying to advertise either, but there's a place called Kima that I've heard that they have some excellent seafood there. And is there any particular place?
I would want to go. You know what? I'd want to see it come off the boat.
Yeah.
And go right in and be cooked.
Yeah.
So I knew it was fresh. Okay. That would be my last perfect meal.
Wow. Well, right on. I tell you what, I can, yeah. Maybe we can go, maybe I can buy you that.
You can buy me shrimp cocktail. Okay, so let's get on a plane. We'll head out west.
Yeah.
You know, maybe hit the coast out there, you know.
Well, Mike, I appreciate it. I thank you so much for being here. Mm-hmm. It means so much to not only me, but also for the engineering field out there, all the engineers listening to this podcast, for you to be on here. A lot of people know you in the engineering field, so I'm sure I'm going to get some pretty good feedback about you being on the show, and I am looking forward to talking to some of the folks in your firm to be able to get on this podcast. And talk
thank
about
you for having me.
Thank you so much, Mike. All right.
Yes, sir.